Welcome to a Monday episode of the Soccer Central podcast. I'm John Molinaro, chief soccer writer for Sportsnet.ca. Hope you all had a lovely weekend and are set to go for a very big week of soccerhead, both internationally and here on the network. Also, for those of you who don't know, I'm now the host of the Soccer Central radio show, which airs Thursday from 8 to 9 p.m. on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. If you can't listen live, don't worry about it. You can download the archives of the show off iTunes and off the Soccer Central podcast page. Today, though, we have two special guests. We'll be talking to ESPN reporter Jeff Carlisle later on. But right now, I'm pleased to welcome Richard Fitzpatrick. Richard is a Spain-based writer and journalist who covers soccer and La Liga in particular for a number of publications, including the Irish Times and the New York Times. He's also the author of El Clásico, Barcelona versus Real Madrid, Football's Greatest Rivalry, a terrific book available on Amazon.com. Richard has agreed to take time out of his schedule to talk to Soccer Central and joins us now on the phone from Barcelona. Richard, how are you, sir?
Very good, John. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, our pleasure. Thanks for coming on. I guess the place to start would be Barcelona's 1-0 loss to Athletic Bilbao on Sunday, the Catalans' first setback in La Liga. What's been the reaction in the Spanish press to that result?
The Spanish and Catalans can be quite melodramatic. They're pretty disappointed. And the front cover on Sports, one of the two daily sports newspapers in Barcelona, said this is not a normal Barça. It's not what they're used to. They've just had two defeats in a row now following their loss to Ajax during the week in the Champions League. It's the first time they had lost two on the hop since last February, March, when they lost to Real Madrid twice in the league and the Copa del Rey, the Spanish cup competition. So it's difficult to know what to make of things. Obviously, it's a setback, but to put it in perspective, they've only their first league defeat of the season. They dropped 5 points from 15 games in the league, so it's not a complete crisis, but it does hint at some underlying problems, and that could be difficult when it comes to crunch time in February, March, when most of the competitions will be decided.
You talked there briefly about some of the underlining problems. What do you think some of the more pertinent ones are for the Catalans?
Well, I suppose if you look at the squad, they have there's gaps in the squad. Now, I don't think any squad is ever complete, so it's an issue that clubs always have to deal with. And Barcelona would certainly have stronger squads than other teams in Spain, with the exception of Real Madrid. But there are a few obvious problems. So if you could start with the goalkeeper, I guess Victor Valdez is out of contract at the end of the season. He'll be leaving the club. And he was injured on Sunday night, so his deputy, Jose Manuel Pinto, was in goal instead, a 38-year-old guy. So they've been scouting around for a replacement keeper. I think that's not as big an issue as their defence. This has been long heralded that they have a problem in central defence. Carlos Puyol, the club captain, is 35 years of age. He's been ravaged with injury for the last three seasons. So he's been in and out of the team. They've been playing a makeshift central defence with Gerard Pique and Mascherano. And look, they've even had to play Adriano a couple of times, Brazilian full-back in there. So they need to buy a traditional and tough centre half, and they've known about this for the last 18 months, but they haven't moved on it. So again, there's a couple of targets they have in mind to fill that, to plug that gap. So it's particularly important because of the Cavalier style of play they have. You know, Barca are famous for their attacking play. Both their full backs, Dani Alves, and then either Adriano on the other side, they're marauding full backs, so that they sometimes effectively only play with two at the back. So they need a stronger central defence. And then up front, they're missing Leo Messi, of course, who's out injured until January. So there's been concerns about over-reliance on Messi since last spring, what the Spanish press call Messi dependencia. He's obviously a phenomenal goal scorer, world player of the year 4 years in a row. So without Messi, the team looks very threadbare. They've got in Neymar Jr. this summer from Brazil, but he's adapted well to the club, but he's not the goal scoring machine that Leo Messi is. They're the kind of the strategic problems they have with their their squad. What's underpinning all of this, of course, is just the high standards that Barcelona set for themselves. They've been in the semi-final of the Champions League for 6 years in a row, which is unprecedented. They've won a platter of trophies, four league titles in the last five seasons, two Champions League titles, a few Spanish cups. So they've set the bar very high. So it's inevitable that the squad would be suffering from fatigue a bit and from a lack of hunger. And you also factor in the great success that the Spain national team has had. So the likes of Xavi, Iniesta, Sergio Busquets, these guys, it's impossible for them to keep going at such a tilt. They're also the Spanish press have been identifying kind of problems in the camp. The club had a poor pre-season. They haven't looked sharp, whether that's down to fatigue that I'm talking about or this poor pre-season and that. But a few factors probably feed into it. And there's also a kind of philosophical debate about their new coach, Tata Martino. He's changed the style of play. Barca are famous for their tiki-taka, possession-based football. But he's trying to mix that up with more direct style of play, which isn't finding favour with the purists in the city.
Gareth Bale over the weekend netted a hat-trick in Real Madrid's 4-0 win over Real Valladolid. How has the Welshman progressed during his brief time in Spain thus far?
He's turning out to be a bargain buy at €100 million. He's adapted well at the moment. I mean, it's early December, and I stress that he's adapting well because he had such a difficult start to his time in Madrid. He only arrived on, I think the deal was closed about the, it was just on the deadline at the end of August, start of September. I think it was the 2nd of September the deal was closed, just a couple of days before the transfer window shut down. So this had been a long transfer saga, huge hype about it all summer, for 3 months that had been going on. And so he arrived with great fanfare. And also, most commentators were saying that he was overpriced. He was 24 years of age, which is truly good age for a footballer, but he had a very impressive season in England last year, player of the year. And that, but he, with his club Tottenham Hotspur, he'd only played one campaign in the Champions League. He has no silverware. Plays internationally with Wales, so he hadn't been playing in any international tournament finals or anything. So for Real Madrid to splurge €100 million was seen as a huge gamble. They have this galactical philosophy where they invest in the best players in the world. So they've had this since their current president came into power in 2000. So when he came in, he signed the likes of Luis Figo, Zidane, David Beckham, and the Brazilian Ronaldo, Cristiano Ronaldo, and Kaká. Most of these guys worked out, with the exception of Kaká, Brazilian. So the kind of policy works, but Gareth Bale didn't come to the club as a Ballon d'Or, as a World Player of the Year winner. So it was a bit of a gamble, but he's been splendid now in the last month or 6 weeks. He initially was struggling with fitness. He didn't play he didn't get rid of his injuries until kind of the end of October. He played in the Clásico on October 26th, and that was, I think, that was only his second start for Real Madrid. But in the last 5 weeks, he's been fantastic. He's got 9 goals, 3 assists. Obviously, the hat trick you mentioned at the weekend, which was what the Spanish refer to as being a perfect hat trick. He scored one with his right foot, one with his left foot, and a header. And he also was taken centre stage because Cristiano Ronaldo was out injured. So this has been as important too. In contrast, obviously, Neymar hasn't been as prolific in his scoring for Barcelona in Messi's absence, and there would be parallels drawn between both situations. So definitely the Prince of Wales has been a success in Madrid.
We're talking to Richard Fitzpatrick, Spanish football journalist and author of the book El Clásico, Barcelona versus Real Madrid, football's greatest rivalry. I was quite impressed with Iker Muniain on Sunday. Aside from scoring the winner for Athletic Bilbao, he caused plenty of problems for Barcelona's back line. He shows a lot of promise, but he's only 20 with one cap to his credit. Is he in discussion for a World Cup roster spot for the Spaniards?
He could well be a bolter. I think you're right to flag his age. He's only 20, although he's quite precocious. He was Athletic Bilbao's youngest ever player to make his debut for the club at 16 in 2009, when he made his league debut against Espanyol. And he's had great success with Spain's under 23 side. He won the European Championships with them in 2011 and again last summer in Israel. So he's a great talent, and he has one appearance for the club or for the country in last year against Venezuela. He played a few minutes coming on as a sub for Cesc Fabregas. Whether he'll make Spain's World Cup squad or even the starting 11, I guess, remains to be seen. Traditionally, Spain's international manager, Vicente del Bosque, is quite conservative, and Spain obviously have an unbelievable amount of quality players to draw on. Just to put it in perspective, at the moment in the Champions League group stages, they have 35 players playing, whereas England, for example, only have 7 players playing in the tournament. He'd have to take his place behind, as a winger, behind the likes of Jesus Navas and Pedro, these kind of guys. So it's a crowded marketplace there.
Right, no doubt. Atletico Madrid is one of the stories that I think not too many people are actually talking about. Diego Simeone's side have already clinched a spot in the knockout round of the Champions League, and they're currently tied with Barcelona for first place in La Liga. How do you account for their success?
I think the first player you'd have to mention is their manager, Diego Simeone. He's only in the job less than 2 years. He arrived in December 2011, and he's really knocked the club into shape. Atletico Madrid are renowned in Spanish football for being disorganized. The club has been run very poorly financially. They have a lot of debt in that, and they go through managers and particularly squad players at an unbelievable rate. Before Simeone arrived, they were going through the turnover of players of 14 a season. So he brought in a lot of stability. He played at the club twice, two stints, one in the 90s and one from around 2003 to 2005. He's a tough, uncompromising player, and his management style is the same. And the team are very, very difficult to break down. And they've been playing with real panache as well. And in particular, obviously, with Diego Costa up front, he's scored, I think, 15 goals now at this stage and only 12 starts. He's out injured for a couple of weeks there. But he's been on fire. He got an incredible bicycle kick goal against Getafe about 10 days ago. So they've been looking very impressive. The only concern is just the depth of their squads. They're tied with Barca at the top of the table at the moment, and they're three ahead of rivals Real Madrid. But they had a great start to last year's league campaign as well, and were flying it until February, but then they waned. And I think they finished 9 points behind their city rival Real Madrid, and something like 25 points behind Barca, the league winners. So it just remains to be seen how they'll get on with the depth of their squad. And as you mentioned, they're kind of fighting a war on a few fronts there with their Champions League success as well. So their resources will be tested.
You mentioned Diego Costa there, and he's obviously made no bones about the fact that he wants to play for Spain, having recently turned down a chance to represent his native Brazil. Del Bosque has let it be known he intends to call him up, but I'm curious as to what the reaction in Spain is among the average fan. Is there any sort of moral uneasiness about this, using a player who wasn't born in the country and who's actually Brazilian?
Yeah, I think there's more upset on the side of Brazil than in Spain. They're quite mercenary, I guess, in Spain. They have a tradition of absorbing these players. The most obvious one is Alfredo Di Stefano in the 50s and 60s. He played for Spain, and he has often been touted as the best player in the world, or certainly in the 50s he was. So they have this tradition, and they have close ties with South America, and that's for family reasons. And that, so from what I've been seeing, that the Spanish aren't too upset about it. They're quite practical about it.
Richard, thanks so much for joining us, and all the best to you in the future.
Great, thank you, Jeff. All the best. Bye.
Cool. We're joined now by Jeff Carlisle, soccer columnist for ESPN, noted for his coverage of both the U.S. national team as well as all matters MLS. Jeff joins us now from the San Francisco Bay Area. Jeff, how are you?
I'm great, John. How are you?
Good, fine. Wow, big week ahead for MLS with Saturday's MLS Cup final between Sporting Kansas City and Real Salt Lake in KC. I know you're going out to cover the game. How do you see these two teams matching up?
Well, I think it's two very evenly matched teams, and I really think it's going to be an especially interesting battle in midfield. You've got a Real Salt Lake team that prides itself on possessing the ball, playing an attractive brand of soccer. And then you've got Kansas City, who certainly can pretty it up when they have a mind to, but are really about, pressing high and disrupting the opposition. So, it's going to be very interesting to see how Real Salt Lake combats that. Certainly a guy like Kyle Beckerman is not going to shy away from any challenges or any physicality. And then on the other side, you've got a guy like Benny Failhaber, who's really come on in the last few playoff games and been the kind of player that I think a lot of U.S. fans expected to see, for much of his career. But, not only did you see him dishing off some impressive assists, but he's been tracking back on defense, which has long been a real big weakness in his game. But, it's going to be interesting to see how these two guys fare. And obviously you got guys like Javier Morales and Paulo Nagamura and Oriol Russell. So it's some interesting matchups just all over the field.
Kansas City obviously has the home field advantage, but I wonder if Salt Lake comes into this with a little bit more momentum, having gotten through a pretty difficult Portland side in the Western Conference Finals.
Certainly, they're playing with a lot of confidence, and I think what we've seen in the playoffs a little bit too is just the way that they've been able to solidify things at the back, and Chris Schuler, his return to the lineup has been a huge boost for them. And this was a guy that, they tabbed to really be the James Olave replacement, and unfortunately for him and for the team, he had some injuries, some foot issues that have really plagued his career, for quite a while now. But he got healthy at the right time and was able to come back, and not only has been fantastic at the defensive end, but has been a real threat on set pieces. So, Real Salt Lake is always a confident team on the ball, but I think, the way they've been able to shore things up on the defensive side, is going to give them even more belief heading into Kansas City.
Right. I think this is, correct me if I'm wrong, this is the second year that the league has staged its championship game at the home of the higher seed as opposed to a neutral site. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you like the change, or do you get a sense of whether or not the league is going to continue with this for the time being or go back to the neutral site?
You know, I think they're going to continue with it because it allows them to kind of fend off the criticism that the regular season doesn't mount for, you know, doesn't matter at all. I think, it is good that a little bit of reward is given to a team that finishes higher in the standings. Personally, I would like to, if they're going to have it at one of the home team's venues, I mean, why not make it two legs? I mean, I think that could be exciting as well. I think for the moment, the league is going to persist with this. I think it is, on the one hand, a good thing that, that regular season performance is rewarded to a degree, because certainly that's not something that takes place during the early rounds of the playoffs. So,
well, and speaking of that, what about the playoff format? Because it's come in for some criticism, especially after New York, who was the best team in the regular season, they bat out in the conference semifinals. Does it have to be tweaked at all?
Well, I mean, I think MLS has been thinking about this for quite a while. They've come upon a bunch of different formats. I mean, there was a period in the league where it was three games, and then they had this kind of awkward, first to 5 point format, which was, I think, kind of tough to explain. Even for huge fans of the game, I think they looked at it with a little bit cock of the head and were a little bit confused by it. So, I think it's just tough to find a good format that can be done. It can be expedited in a relatively quick manner. But at the same time, offering up some compelling play. I do think one problem for this year has been, the two gaps that they've had in terms of, the two-week lag between, I think it was the conference semifinals and the conference final, the first leg of the conference final and then the second leg, and now it's another 2 weeks to get to MLS Cup. So I think that has really kind of robbed this playoff season of some rhythm, just being able to maintain some momentum in terms of getting the league noticed and getting it out there. So, I think that's been a big problem this year. But in terms of tweaking it, I'm not sure that they can really do much else. One idea is if the two teams are tied at the end of 90 minutes, that, the higher-seeded team, gets to go through. So, I mean, that's something that's been done, in Mexico over the years. So, but again, extra time is obviously very compelling. So there's give and take to it. I'm sure the people at MLS headquarters are really, racking their brains to try to come up with a better way. But I think for the moment, I think the two-leg format, in the conference semifinals and finals and then a one-off, I think that's probably the best that they're going to be able to do for the moment.
We're talking to Jeff Carlisle, soccer columnist for ESPN. Portland's Caleb Porter was named Coach of the Year today. No real surprise there, I don't think.
No, I think he was the leading candidate. They were the team that improved the most, and then the coach of that team is the one that that tends to grab that award. I think not only for the way he turned the team around, but for the way he did it. They played a style that was real easy on the eyes, and it was really fun to watch, and they had some compelling players. You have guys like Diego Valeri and Darlington Nagbe, and then Will Johnson had a fantastic season as well. So full credit to him. I was a skeptic. I'll raise my hand and say that I was a little puzzled by the appointment given what happened in the Olympics. But certainly he's Caleb Porter has proved me wrong and done a fantastic job really in turning around that team.
The league's MVP award winner is going to be announced in the coming days with Mike McGee, Robbie Keane, and Marco DeVayo up for the honor. Who did you vote for?
I voted for Robbie Keane. I thought, he was the most consistent player, a guy who not only scored a ton of goals but had a ton of assists as well. I think, given the fact that not only was that LA side missing David Beckham, but they also were obviously without Mike McGee. It's interesting to think what that team would have been like in the playoffs if McGee had still been an LA Galaxy player. But for me, I think even though that Keane missed some time, obviously on international duty, for me he was the best player and certainly contributed to the team's attack in a lot of ways. And on a team that outside of him and Landon Donovan didn't have a ton of offensive options. Granted, those are two awesome options to have, but it was a Galaxy team that was a little bit limited in terms of having a varied attack, if you were. So, Keane was my pick. That's not to say that McGee isn't deserving. I mean, I certainly won't be gnashing my teeth if McGee is the guy who ends up winning it, because obviously you could argue he was the MVP of two teams. I mean, he was carrying LA early and then obviously helped Chicago turn their season around, even though they just felt short of making the playoffs. So, if one of those two guys wins it, I won't have a problem with it.
Anyone left off the list of finalists that you think deserve to be there?
Well, I mean, you can make a case, for certainly a guy like Valeri. I mean, he came on strong during the end. I think, when a lot of the MVP discussion was beginning to start, he was dealing with some injuries. I think he had a little bit of a hip injury that actually he had to deal with throughout the end of the regular season. I think that started around the August time frame, and that impacted his effectiveness a little bit, but then he finished strong. Certainly a guy like Javier Morales. I mean, I think, in the playoffs especially, we've seen a Morales that has kind of gotten back to the form where he was at, several years ago before he had that terrible broken ankle. So, I think those two guys certainly would have been, deserving to be, in the top three. And then you got a guy like Camilo, who was the Golden Boot winner. I mean, usually that's an automatic entree into getting into the top three. But obviously, when your team doesn't make the playoffs, you kind of, your candidacy is vulnerable to getting left off that final list. And I think that was that was the case with Camilo, even though he scored a lot of goals and some of them of the utterly spectacular variety. So I think he was another guy who could easily have been on that list.
On Tuesday, Commissioner Don Garber is going to kick off MLS Cub Week by delivering a State of the League address. What's your view, Jeff, on the general health of Major League Soccer?
I think overall it's never been better. I mean, you've got cities queuing up to get expansion franchises, and these new clubs are shelling out a ton of money to join it. I mean, you can point to New York and New York City FC and the $100 million that they spent, but even Orlando, I think it was upwards of $70 million that they had to pay to get into the league. So that's certainly a healthy sign that there are these deep-pocketed owners that are wanting to get into MLS. In terms of the level of play, opinions vary about whether expansion is really diluting the talent. I think that's mitigated somewhat by the fact that foreign players can be brought in and maybe prop up the level of play on the field, if you will. But, certainly this is a league that has been built on North American players. And definitely going to come a point, I think, where expansion is going to dilute the product a little bit. And it'll be interesting to see if some of these player development initiatives, with the Development Academy, the homegrown contracts, things of that sort can combat that. But I think if you're MLS, you have really no choice but to take this opportunity to grow and to add these teams. And, the league has never been in a better spot.
What about?
I do think one area of concern is the television rating.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, it seems to be, it's going up. The game's going to be on Saturday. I'm sure it's going to be going up against some college football action. How does the team address, or how does the league address its just sort of, almost stagnant TV ratings?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, and I'm sure that's one that the commissioner will be asked. It's interesting to see that the ratings have gone down a bit this year. Certainly you could probably attribute some of that to the fact that David Beckham is no longer in the league. I mean, he still has just immense drawing power, and obviously the league wants to get him in as an owner now. But it's a tricky thing to try to address. I mean, I think having a consistent time slot each week would certainly help that to a degree, so that if people are if it's Friday or if it's Saturday, hey, I know that if I sit down in front of my TV at this particular time of the day, there's going to be an MLS game on. It's, I think that definitely, cuts into the ratings. I mean, certainly the time slots are not always favorable as well. I mean, certainly ESPN has broadcast some games on the West Coast where it's been very late on the East Coast, and obviously that's going to impact things as well. So, I think trying to get some more favorable earlier time slots and a dedicated time each week will help in that regard. But it's complicated. I mean, if it were just that easy, I'm sure MLS would have tried to do that a long time ago. So it's going to be an ongoing process to see how they, can increase those TV ratings and then really drive revenues in a different way than just expansion fees or ticket sales or even sponsorships and the like.
What about some of the other pressing issues that need to be addressed going forward? I mean, I've long held that there has to be sort of greater transparency within the league. I mean, we're all kind of playing this guessing game in terms of, you know, allotments and rules and allocation money. Do you get a sense that this is we're going to an era of greater transparency from the league, and we'll kind of get to see fully behind the curtain of what's going on?
No, I don't. And I say that as someone who, like yourself, would very much like to see a greater amount of transparency in that regard. Let's face it, if it wasn't for the MLS Players Union, we probably wouldn't even know a lot of the salaries that these guys are getting paid and the impact that they have on the cap. And even that's not 100% transparent, because obviously you can use allocation money to buy down contracts and things of that sort.
Right.
So, but you talk to the commissioner, you talk to other executives in the league, and there really is not an appetite for, announcing things like allocation money and even rule changes. I mean, this concept of a league designated player, and then, the retention fund that was kind of, dropped on the media at the All-Star game. It's just like, wait a minute.
Right.
You made a rule change, and now you're telling us halfway through the season that, that this is done. I guess on the one hand, yes, the teams know, and they're operating under that assumption. But I don't see any business reason why something like a retention fund should not be made public. But for whatever reason, the league is taking a very conservative approach, and really has no appetite to make these things public. And only if there's money, only if the league can benefit monetarily, does it seem like do these things ever become public. So it's, I think it's a real weakness of the league, and it hurts the league's credibility, I think, to a certain degree, to not divulge these things, the way they are in other sports.
Well, I think you raise a good point there, because it's something that, as you said, when they sort of, not that they're necessarily doing it, but it certainly has the appearance that they're making rules as they go along. And they're not sort of, completely upfront about it. So it certainly appears as though that there's something untoward. And as I said, as you said, it really kind of hurts their credibility in the public eye, especially to non-soccer fans and non-soccer media.
Absolutely. And their position baffles me to a degree. I think in most situations, everyone would agree that more transparency is a good thing, especially when you think back to the Wild West days of the league's early years, when things like allocation dollars and even how much each team was getting, even that was held secret. So it's something that I think really needs to change, and but who knows when that will happen? Because certainly there doesn't seem to be much of an appetite to do that going forward.
Yeah, fair enough. Jeff, before we let you go, tell our listeners where and how they can check out some of your fine work. Maybe what's your Twitter handle, and where can they check out your work online?
My Twitter handle is Jeffrey Carlisle, not Jeff, because I think that's some old police chief in South Florida. But it's Jeffrey Carlisle, and they can find me at ESPNFC.com. If they just go to the search bar and then type in Jeff Carlisle, I mean, they'll get an archive of all my stuff. So if they miss something in the carousel, the day that a piece of mine comes out, they can still go back and check out some of my previous articles. So that's the way around that.
Good stuff, Jeff. Thanks for joining us. Keep up the good work, and have fun in Kansas City.
Will do, John. Thanks very much.
Cool. Okay, folks, that's another edition of the Soccer Central podcast in the books. Check back on Thursday, as we're going to do another show. In the meantime, cheers for listening.